policy, and looks like we're on the record.
Great.
Again, welcome everybody. A few announcements, and then again, depending on what questions or everybody may have, we may have a unusually short meeting today. Don't know. But a few announcements I wanted to say. One, update you all on the ongoing efforts to get data, statistics. So, you know, the relevant in particular to, you know, the set of recommendations about fines, we have not received any fine data, right? Like, you know, this was part of our original request to the Sentencing Commission. We were told to expect that eventually. We still haven't received anything from the Sentencing Commission with respect to fines. So we have moved on to speak directly to the Superior Court. And actually, we're hopeful now that in a fairly short amount of time, we're going to have a significant amount of data, including fine data, direct from the courts. So that will hopefully give a sense of what's going on in this arena. When we put together the recommendations, which, you know, report number 5, which is on the agenda, you know, right, we're kind of shooting in the dark, right, as to what's really going on, what's being assessed, how much the Victims of Violent Crime Fund is really the main financial sanction or fee or penalty, however you want to describe it, which I don't know, frankly. There's it's a very sparse area in terms of case law and trying to understand how to parse these aspects of fines. So we're really hoping to actually have some basis to see what's going on. We will update then you as we get the data and have a chance to analyze it. But just want to let you know, we are going to have something now, it looks like. It may be a month out. And hopefully we'll be able to get some data on other issues as well. Again, misdemeanors. We didn't have anything so far on misdemeanors except some bare frequency data that we got a few years back. So looking forward to that. And welcome Chanel's joined us.
Hi.
Interns, folks, we can talk afterwards, but this is Chanel. She's representing the Judiciary Committee's staff and Councilmember Allen. So and Chanel, just so you know, Michael's on the phone joining us, but right now that's all that's on the phone. Data that's there. Second piece, which is relevant again to draft report number 5, which refers to the ALI's recommendations on sentencing. There's a footnote or two kind of speaking to this in the materials, but I want to really kind of emphasize the ALI just had its final vote on its recommendations at its annual meeting a few weeks ago. We don't have a copy yet of the very final language, including any amendments that were made at the final adoption, but most of those recommendations were adopted at prior sessions. So this was kind of the final vote on the entire piece and any final changes. I will forward on a link to that as soon as we get it or it's available publicly. It covers a lot of ground and I think is going to become, you know, the new kind of best practice recommendations floating out there. Now, it is about sentencing generally. It speaks to how sentencing commissions should be set up, you know, structure, function, responsibilities. It goes into, again, some issues of statutory matters, again, gradations and penalty classes, which is relevant kind of more immediately to what we're doing. It looks at things like merger, issues that come up in sentencing and, again, are going to be relevant to what we do. So I'll pass that on and just want to kind of generally note that, you know, it's a big deal, right? This is over a decade in development. It includes, you know, a number of federal D.C. Judges, Judge Wald. I don't remember who else from the district, but
Judge Epstein. Right.
Judge Epstein. So they have multi-tiers, it's hard to kind of piece out what's going on, but yes, a number of DC practitioners and lawyers were at least part of what they call their members advisory group, which is a little bit different than they have like another committee that kind of works more directly under the reporters. Anyway, a lot of people had hands in this. It's a totally updates, obviously, the Model Penal Code's recommendations from 1963, and has a lot of great research attached to it as well, which we've used and will continue to use. So I want to point that out. Moving quickly forward. July 5th is going to be our next meeting. Just to clarify, we had that whole email chain. After looking for other alternatives, we ended up back with sticking with our original July 5th meeting date. So 2 to 4 o'clock, July 5th, per the usual, we'll be keeping that.
And you have a sense that most people are going to be able to come on that day?
On that day, it appears that everybody except Dave has a yet another intervening matter, which is even more amazing.
I'm probably going to be in Tobago teaching juvenile justice for the practitioners who want to redo the juvenile justice system.
And we're not all going.
And we're apparently not invited. So
you could have gone, but you have a meeting.
Yeah. Exactly. So the rest of you, July 5th, next meeting. We're going to cancel the August meeting, I think, that had multiple conflicts. Rescheduling. I will start another email chain on rescheduling an extra session either, and let me float this, for the last week of August or mid-September. So right now we have, again, on the books already that regular first Wednesday in September. But the question is to add in time. Is there generally, again, I'm not committed, but you know, should I float dates that last week of August, week of August 28th, or move on into mid-late September? Anybody have a sense on that? Are you unavailable last week of August, or just kind of like?
Is the last week of August the one that starts on the 28th?
That's correct. Yep, the week of August 28th. If not,
I'm good. By the way, in
August. Okay. At least potentially, you cannot. Would mid-September be possible? Some the dates in there. Okay. Katya, Chanel, possible.
Looks like the last week of August is fine with my schedule.
Okay. Great. Good. Well, I will float around, see what the best we can do, and honestly. The subject for that, I assume, will be property offenses, right? So we're planning to get out the big package of property offenses here in, well, we're probably July in terms of the sequencing. And that will give, it'll be a lot. You know, we're talking 30 offenses. We're going to try to do it as a one big cluster so you can see the interrelationships. We're developing it so that we can see the relationships and try to be as kind of clear and consistent across the board as we can. So that's going to be the issue, and you know, hopefully we can get full attendance. I'll try to float some dates now so we can set it. Last thing I wanted to say, sorry for all this, we will either later today or tomorrow morning be sending out the next batch of recommendations. Now, this overlaps a bit. You still have until the end of next week with regard to the prior set, which, again, it's you know, what's up on the board, this the first draft of report number 5 and the second draft of report number 2. So we can talk about that today, but the actual written comments are due the end of next week. That Friday is the deadline. We're going to start the clock. We're going to get, you know, I think it's going to be a little bit more than 6 weeks. So it'll get you to mid-July for this next set of recommendations. And it's going to be two things. It's going to be dealing with some general enhancements that apply broadly to all offenses, all specific offenses, and attempt, which is, you know, still largely a matter of common law in the district. So we will be trying to codify more specifically definitions. Penalties, again, we'll wait, as with everything else, regarding penalties and proportionality. But look for that, again, either today or tomorrow, and it'll be comments due mid-July. All right. That's it for a lot of announcements. On the agenda. So we went through quite a number of comments on reports 3 and 4 and addressed a number of those. I think that the place to start, though, is to see if anybody had any other issues regarding the written comments that were submitted, right? Any follow-up? I think from staff's perspective, we discussed last meeting, the thornier issues. So I think, we're fine. We're going to follow up. For instance, OAG raised that, one comment about the relevancy to civil liability. We'll follow up on that. Totally agree. It's just a matter of drafting language for that.
Yeah.
And again, all of this will come out in a second draft, in which case you'll have another crack at it for comments. So, but if there's anything as a group you want to discuss in those, anything more I want to just check? No. All right. Great. Okay. Then the two other pieces which we did not get to on the agenda at all last time were the second draft of report number 2. Which is, chiefly about that change for mental states, adding in with intent to, in that inchoate form. And then the first draft of report number 5, which puts out offense classes and penalties. Again, written comments not due on this yet until the end of next week. But, want to open it up to any kind of questions or comments. First, on the second draft of report number 2. Again, this is the report dealing with the with intent language, and see if there's anything we can address together as a group right now. Michael's on the phone. He was kind of lead on this, and so we're happy to take any questions, but affirmatively, I don't know that there's any, this is something, for those of you who have been in the prior iteration, we dealt with before, have this kind of with intent language, and it seems I would just paint a broad brush here and say, it makes it easier to kind of what we were translating, as it were, at least many parts of current district law, where that language is used, either in the jury instructions or in the actual statute. And I think, it makes sense for us to carry that over. So we wanted to, create a concrete, specific way to do it. And, of course, in many respects, you don't need this language, except, as Renato always kind of pointed out, that, it's grammatically strange to be talking about future results, that may or may not occur as happening, with knowledge that this, that's essentially the kind of the level in the mental state hierarchy that you're trying to cover is knowledge and purpose. But we wanted to make clear that it is capturing, that person's belief, essentially, that to a practical certainty that such and such will follow, such result will follow. So, open it up for questions on that report. Any comments or questions?
I just thought of a question.
Sure.
Which means it's probably not a super well thought out thing. But I thought it was fine. I was like, we're all good to go. But something about what you just said made me think, mm-hmm. even before you mentioned hierarchy, how does the intent fit in with, right? The sort of proof of the higher means you're okay on the lower. Does it still work? Since this is now just...
Yeah.
Great question. Go, Michael.
What we'll be doing is when we release the next draft, be clarifying and modifying the sort of the general provision that sort of sets out that hierarchical relationship, because, what's intended is basically whether it's not... And the same hierarchical rule applies such that, so just as previously, if you would say, if an offense prohibited knowingly killing, that would mean either knowledge or purposely killing, if purpose would be read in. So also with intent, the, what is expected is that purpose be an alternative to the belief-like mental state there. So, and it's by virtue of that sort of like hierarchical rule substitution that enables intent to be, have its sort of traditional common law understanding. Right? So the traditional common law understanding of intent is that it's either a conscious desire to see a result happen or belief that a result is practically certain. And so it's by virtue of the definition of intent read in light of the rule of substitution, which will be revised to clarify how intent fits in. That is basically the same as knowledge that gets you to that end result.
So we have to think about it going up, right, to purpose, but also going down, right?
It's treated again, essentially defined the same as knowledge. So in the hierarchy, proof of purpose or would suffice to also prove intent. And again, it's essentially equivalent to knowledge with that slight tweak as to future results. Does that
right? So yeah, intent and knowledge are just that. Substantively they're the same. It's really just like semantically and for purposes of offense articulation, right? So knowledge is awareness. That has to do with respect to results, at least awareness that a result is practically certain to occur, whereas intent is defined as belief that a result is practically certain to occur. And this sort of thing matters. So, for example, when you're drafting inchoate offenses, you want to say with intent to, assault with intent to kill, rather than assault with knowledge that one will kill. Or even, in terms of articulating what the mens rea of attempt is, let's say, you wouldn't necessarily say a person has act with knowledge that a result will occur, because in many situations where an attempt is charged or the result hasn't occurred. So it would just be misleading to say knowledge. So this is, for the most part, intended to just be a sort of, a semantic drafting tool. And that will be, hopefully clarified in the materials that are distributed, but will also be further clarified in the rule of, in the hierarchical rule of substitution. And that's right, Laura, that intent, like knowledge, would satisfy proof of recklessness in the same way.
Okay. I guess because the question just occurred to me, I sort of haven't thought out whether I would find that confusing. The going up is, I get how purposefully, right, with respect to result, consciously desiring that one's conduct caused the result, I understand how if you proved that you sort of would subsume in that you believe that one's conduct is practically certain to cause the result. I get, so I think that one fits fine with me. What I haven't figured out is if I prove the with intent, does it automatically, with the structure, work with recklessness or negligence? And Michael says yes. That's what I heard him say.
Works,
but I haven't.
But it doesn't satisfy. Those are lower. That is.
But I thought that was the rule, right? If you prove the higher, then you satisfied the lower.
Right. I'm sorry,
and so
yes.
That's the point.
That's
is
correct.
Does it, when you change that language?
That's right.
Am I going to agree that proof of just the belief is going to satisfy the lower?
That's right. So
Michael seems convinced, yes, I want to read it.
That's right.
Think about it.
That's right. And I think the kicker is, where is this actually going to show up? It's going to be with these inchoate elements, right? Theft, it's with the intent to deprive. You don't actually have to deprive. And so it's...
attempt.
The usual place, like the places you already expect, essentially, for kind of with intent to go in. I don't think it's ever going to be
that,
like,
fitting may not matter?
Yeah, I just where you're like, the element says reckless, but does with intent satisfy that? You're going to look to knowledge and see if knowledge satisfies. It's that inchoate form. Now, again, maybe it's a worthwhile question. Go ahead.
Yes, I was just going to say, Laura, the only situation where this would arise is if we tried to draft an inchoate offense that added recklessness as to, like, a circumstance. So you could imagine a version of RSP that was drafted to, require someone to possess property with recklessness as to whether that property was stolen. Let's just assume what that means is that the property doesn't actually have to be stolen. It's that the person has to, in his own mind, be aware of a substantial risk that the property was stolen. So then I guess the question, which I guess you raise, is it intuitive or not, separate and apart from what the, I guess, you know, the rules of substitution specify, that someone who's practically certain that the property they're possessing is stolen would, by, you know, by definition, believe there is a substantial risk that the property is stolen.
I guess I would just say this. I think my question is sort of two things. What made me think of it, now I know why I thought of it, is because you have it in here as knowledge and intent, and you smushed intent in with knowledge, which means it then is automatically inserted into this hierarchy.
Right.
And so one is the substantive question of does this work, and or maybe it never comes up. But the other is, have you written the rule of substitution or the whatever in a way that now that you've put this in, the way you've worded that still fits and makes sense? Or do you need to take a look at how we've expressed that rule to make sure that even though we've now shoved this thing in at the level of knowledge, we need to
I think the short answer is right. We do, like, for instance, what's on the screen right now, you know, proof of knowledge, right? This is in that hierarchy, Michael, we're just looking at the bottom of it, right? So subsection E.
Right.
You know, right now we've only phrased that in terms of negligence, recklessness, and knowledge. You know, it should be proof of knowledge or intent. You know, there are, like, some conforming amendments. Assuming we don't get, it looks like generally everybody's on board with this. We'll, in the next draft, kind of update these other parts to make sure that they reflect this change. So we wanted to kind of float this first, make sure it was, acceptable, and then, but you're right, we will need to tweak that. And, for instance, the commentary, also slightly, to make sure that, again, that's clearly reflected its equivalency to knowledge throughout.
Good to flag it, but I also want to note, like, the interaction of all the different pieces is part of what drove the model penal code folks to develop some very arcane language and difficult language.
Yeah.
And our folks have done an amazing job of simplifying and keeping it very clear without losing the nuance that the model penal code has. It's an achievement.
Thank you. Yeah, and I give particular, you know, Michael deserves the real kudos here. And it is like, you know, the model penal code definitions, while broadly accepted, even on these, like, definitions for knowledge and purpose, are kind of crazy when you, like, look at them in closely, because they are asymmetric. And what they're trying to do is they're trying to, like, play out in a practical way how these inchoate type forms work out. And we're pretty convinced that this will work. It'll clarify things, and, you know, but the proof's going to be in the pudding of when we see this in specific offenses, right? Is it going to work out? And so, property offenses, we're going to have a ton right away where we're going to have, you know, with intent to, you know, deprive. It's going to be, you know, very, you know, for thefts, a number of other elements. So I think you'll see it work out fairly quickly. We can revisit it, you know, again, if it's problematic, but.
I have just one
picayune
one.
Please.
And it's just a wording thing that I think tightens it a little. There are three places in 206 where you follow the pattern. A person does something that a person, and then it refers desires that ones.
Okay.
And the one, although I think it's obvious, is who the one is, the person.
Okay.
It just doesn't seem to be as tight as possibly saying, like, a person acts purposely with respect to result, but that person consciously desires that his or her conduct causes the result.
Sure,
and
sure.
There are two other places where that happened. So the one is tightened into the person.
Sure.
Great.
Thoughts on that? I will say, like, you know, staff points like that, you know, I don't know, you know, won't put John on the spot, but, you know, Renata often, like, is one of our stricter on, like, those language details and particularly things that, like, you know, but if anybody has, like, you know, preference on which way to go with this, I totally get the consistency point. We need to be consistent, but whether it's ones or the his, her, you know, the
I don't mind the singular.
I think Renata
there.
Would not like there.
She wouldn't, but I'm a big fan of the singular there.
But her children are pushing her in the direction of thinking about it.
Very good. All right. Well, we'll definitely look at that again. If anybody wants to piece of that, you know, let us know what your thoughts are on which way to go, which drafting choice. Good. Other thoughts or questions, small or big? If not, we'll move on to the last draft report number 5, which is the offense classes. And on that, you know, before kind of opening up, I wanted to kind of like emphasize a few of the caveats that are in the memo, which was accompanying it. And, you know, I hate to be heavy-handed on this, but I want to be heavy-handed on this. Because, you know, well, a few things. You know, one, I wanted to be clear that, you know, the whole setup of what we're doing, right, it creates all these chicken-egg problems. We got to float some stuff first so that people can coherently think through the specific offenses. But on the back end, when we get to penalties, it may be that once you see how the offenses have gelled, where the gradations are, you may shift your thinking as to where the appropriate penalty classes are. So what we've tried to do now is, you know, put out what we think are, again, you know, the charts in the tables in the memo kind of show. This largely tracks where current law is in terms of the options that are most used. There are funky things in there. You know, we have 7-year terms, you know, carjacking in particular seems particularly weird. Anyway, you know, like there are a lot of offenses that don't quite match the class options that we're putting out there, but we think this pretty much covers the spectrum. And again, so the first caveat is this will get, we're not expecting changes to it now, so I want to be clear about that. And would ask you, if you see as we go through particular offenses, you know, you can already see, hey, this doesn't line up. You know, either it's, for instance, I don't know, particularly at the bottom end, maybe for felonies, or at the top end for felonies, you might think that, like, this doesn't match the options that you put out there. Note it for us. Because what we're trying to do is, as we go through specific offenses, we're thinking through gradations, and already going to be pitching, you know, changes to gradations to make it more proportional. But again, it's at the back end where you start putting on numbers and assigning them to a particular class that we're going to have to, like, you know, really put the jigsaw puzzle together and see. And it may be, again, a really flag at the top of the felonies, maybe at the bottom of the felonies. Those are places where there might be, you know, everybody at the end kind of saying, hey, I think there should be a change here. Don't know. We're not planning on it. Please flag it as we go along. But so this is what this is our working basis. Second point was made in the memo. Specific offenses can deviate, right? So I really want to stay away from this if at all possible. These are really going to be, if anything, a rare exception. And I don't know that we'll be recommending any.
One, if you will.
Well, there we go. Okay.
which is why I thought actually it should start with offense classifications unless otherwise authorized by law. Parental kidnapping. And that's because it's a felony, and it has to be a felony in order to be extraditable. So you might as well put in that extra language in front because we know of at least one exception.
Which is to say, I'm sorry. Say more why it would be an exception right now.
Because I believe it's either 180 or a 6-month offense, depending on whether you transport out of the jurisdiction or stay in the jurisdiction, but when you took the kid. But in order for it to be extraditable, it has to be designated as a felony.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's the one weird that we have dealt with before in the Sentencing Commission context of
good.
It says this is a felony even though the penalty is
and the concern is, again,
you don't call it federal.
Yeah. So I would ask this too, and I this is a ignorant, you know, particularly towards you, Dave. I think, like, you know, if there are other offenses which, again, the designation has implications for federal funding, right? Motor vehicle stuff, you know, flag that for us too.
Sure.
Okay, so right, you know, we totally want to, you know, respect that, but and be aware of it. But so there might be some other things there too where eventually we come down on a penalty or a classification that puts it out of joint with requirements for federal funding or something, and then we need to look at options for options on how to
absolutely
address
I'll look at it. I guess we all will take a look at it.
Yeah.
But because we know parental kidnapping is there,
thank you.
We might as well build it into the intro language of 801.
Thank you.
And maybe the definitions.
Thank you. And again, you think except other we'll
some
we'll
language that. Like
exactly,
that.
Exactly. We'll figure that out. Again, so I will say this, you know, parental kidnapping is an interesting example because, you know, it's not a Title 22 offense. Like, you know, I don't know to what extent we will be touching that, right?
But you want to leave the option open for the city council in a Title 22 offense to do something if we know that they're ready other places. In other words, it might be, you know, a historical accident that the Codification Council included parental kidnapping in Title 23 rather than in Title 22 or how they drafted it.
Well, and one thing I'd point out too, so, you know, right now, and again, this is, you know, we have this language in 104A, you know, that you know, unless otherwise provided by law, provisions in Subtitle 1, including these penalty classifications, apply to other provisions of Title 22A. So, you know, that's our general language, which, you know, unless otherwise provided by law, again, emphasizing these are default categories. We can have specific deviations in any specific offense. I'm not sure that we need to, you know, because, look, any of these general provisions, I suspect there's going to be places where, you know, that unless otherwise provided by law, like, you know, other stuff outside of Title 22, you know, there's going to be weird cross relationships happening. That's why, you know, this was kind of set up to be the applicable default for reformed offenses, but allowing through this to say that there can be deviations as specifically provided.
My only concern with that is the timing of the enacting of the offenses.
Yeah.
Because if you have an offense that occurs after this, then obviously the city council can amend it and give something that varies from it.
Yeah.
But if it's an offense that pre-existed this, then the question is, would the Court of Appeals, I'm looking at the Court of Appeals person, would the Court of Appeals look at it and say, it was a pre-existing offense when they created this, is a problem?
Yeah.
I mean, you could also just add the unless otherwise provided by law at a larger level of abstraction in this, right? So that it's not in that specific provision, but is at the very beginning of that section.
Right. So, good. We'll chew on this. And I think, you know, now that Dave's raised it, in anybody's written comments, if you have any comments, address that. Chime in. Yeah, and chime in on this, too, because I think this would be a helpful point. And exactly where and how we address this, it should be addressed.
Yeah, that's my major point.
It's just a question of what's the best way to do it. And, yeah, you know, the end game, right, speculative as it is, like, really definitely could influence this on sequencing. Okay, well, thank you for that. Again, you know, so we can't have other specific deviations from these classes. We're not planning on any, and particularly with respect to the classes, want to avoid them. This is how codes fall apart, right? Like, this is how suddenly, oh, well, now we'll have a 21-year offense instead of just the 20-year offense. And there's, you know, a lot of reasons for the classification system and why it's been generally adopted. And one of the big ones is actually not about legal practitioners, it's about the legislatures. and being able, and sentencing commissions, and these other bodies who, you know, to be able, as we're going to try to do, to equate across a class and say, hey, this class is of roughly equal seriousness, whatever's in that pot, whatever's in that box, such that then any changes in recommendations from council, you know, can deal with that as a class rather than singling out individual things which might become hot at a given time, and instead step back and say, hey, okay, we could change the penalty for, you know, whatever, you know, RSP, Or maybe what we need to also do is reevaluate, is that class too low, too high?
Mandatory, is it in the right class?
I'm sorry?
Is it in the right
class? Is it in the right class? Exactly. So we want to stick with that. Couple last things, and I just want to be very open about this on the mandatory minimum question, which we are not touching at this point, either statutory or mandatory. You know, so in the district, we have a lot of things on the books which read as if they were mandatory minima. Like, you would read it, you would think, like, oh, a judge is not allowed to go below that. But we largely, through the nomenclature of this sentencing commission, at least, maybe it predates that somewhere, you know, this distinction between statutory and mandatory minima. Statutory minima, yeah, that particular statute might say shall be punished between, you know, 3 and 15 years. But unless it has a more specific hook, statement that says, notwithstanding any other provision of law, or, you know, sometimes it says mandatory minimum, unless there's some other language, judges have the ability to suspend portions of that sentence to go below what is the apparent minimum just in that statute. So we call those statutory minima because, again, functionally, you can get sentences below that. Whether that ends up being a part of the recommendations here is a big question, and it's one I think best addressed at the end when we're looking at penalties. Again, when you have before you a set of, you know, a complete set of recommendations that looks at all the gradations, and you know, look, mandatory minima are obviously a much talked about and controversial issue. I think a lot is lost in the broad, you know, talk about it in general terms. And what really matters is where specifically are you talking about them, and what level are they, right? You know, there's a lot of concern been voiced about certain very high level mandatory minimum sentences. It matters maybe what the penalty, what number is going with that. I guess I'd just say. Right, you know, and so we'll have a conversation about that, and we're gonna have to wrestle with it. But I think now is not the time. So by putting out those classes, they don't have a bottom number. They don't, and we're not presuming that, oh, if we say theft is a class, whatever, 4 felony or 3 felony or 1, whatever, we're not saying that it won't have either statutory minimum, which again is kind of a functional way for the legislature to communicate, hey, we really think it shouldn't go below that, but you can, judges can, or a hard mandatory minimum. We're not trying to communicate anything one way or the other about that right now. Okay? We're going to leave that to the penalty phase when I think we can all make a more careful kind of discussion about how it applies for these offenses. The last point was in the memo, just, you know, the Class A designations we're also punting on, which has more to do with procedural issues, and, you know, floats out there. But okay, with those caveats, and again, the notion that we're going to have more data on, Sean, this will follow up later, but, you know, we're going to have more data on fines soon from the courts, which could influence this, right? Like, again, this was put together largely based on the Fine Proportionality Act and how it's kind of lined up. If in practice things are totally different, you know, that's definitely an opening to reconsider how the statutes should be working here. But we don't have any picture right now of how in practice fines are being applied, at what levels. I'm not aware of anything. If anybody, by the way, is aware of any district-specific analysis of this, I'd love to, we haven't seen anything, and so it's really, you know, even with those from the Sentencing Commission, you know, when the Fine Proportionality Act came out, like, it to a significant degree rationalized fines compared to where they were, but again, kind of shooting in the dark, and so far as, you know, it was pegged to whatever the statutory penalties are, which may or may not be where they should be, high or low, but it also just, like, I don't think the Sentencing Commission, this predates me, had any data behind the scenes on how fines were being assessed or applied. Was that any, I'm looking at kind of Dave and Laura on this, so was there any like sense that like that informed
your... I don't remember any studies on fines on use, especially in felonies.
Yeah, no.
I know that the fine question had a list of exceptions.
Exactly.
You know, about when this would not apply.
Yeah.
For various reasons.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Okay, well, so we'll proceed, and again, those exceptions are notable too. We're not at this point making, cutting out exceptions for things. It may make sense, right? Like particularly white collar crime, right? Like this is where, but we've already got this like organizational defendant thing, which was
which
already
also,
in the unfortunately,
which you know may need some tweaking.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything? Okay. Well, at that point, I'll open it up. But yeah,
I've got a couple of picayune things.
Okay, please.
Page 5 commentary.
Okay.
You say in the first paragraph, this non-exhaustive list includes the typical sanctions for felonies. Isn't it the typical sanction for any offense? I'm not sure why. You know, misdemeanor could have probation, could have imprisonment, could have a fine, could have.
I'm sorry. Are you in the report or
page
in the
5
memo? In the report.
I'm sorry. Of the report.
Okay.
Because I'm assuming these are the commentaries that may go along to the council.
Yeah. Pull it up on the screen for everybody to look at while we go there. So, first draft. Page 5?
Yeah.
Just the first paragraph.
First paragraph under commentary. I'm just not sure. Third line down.
Okay.
Towards the right side. I'm not sure why that's designated as a felony as opposed to any other offense.
Right. Fair point. I don't know. We can. Yep.
It should be. Yeah, for an event.
Typicals, just or sanctions.
You word it any you want. Good. Yep. But misdemeanors fall in the same.
It's fair
category.
Point. Yep.
Above that, just real quick, while we're on that page, that 24903 is not a correct site.
Okay, for post-release supervision.
Well, I don't know what you're talking about there. So that's a Youth Act, but it's not even the beginning of Youth Act, which is the 24901. That's what I was just looking at in the book, which was my guess. Do you mean supervised release, as in what you see in 24904.01?
Yes.
Anyway, someone...
That was what was intended.
Okay.
We'll...
It's just a typo then.
Yeah, we'll check that. Okay. Yeah, there was... Yeah, good.
That was going to be my entire memo. Shit.
If anybody has any other issues that they want to slip to Laura to put in, other questions or comments?
I interrupted Dave.
Yep.
So.
No, that's. I got one on page 8 if nobody's got any before page 8.
Okay. Hearing nothing, you're on, Dave.
Okay, look at that last paragraph.
Okay.
The last sentence under Supreme Court, it starts second and last day.
Okay.
Well, offenses involving of 6 months or more are subject. I don't think that's correct.
Okay.
I think the case says under Supreme Court precedent, offenses involving penalties of more than 6 months
more than six,
require
right.
a jury trial.
Very good. Yep. Yep.
And in fact, I think you cite to the right case.
No, exactly.
On
it was
the
just,
next page.
It was just phrased off. Yep. Yep. Unless anybody, we'll look at that too for clarify that. And on that point, again, it was not clear, but in general, what we're, the 6 month, 180 day distinction on the books is pretty opaque to anybody who's not a DC criminal lawyer as to like the ramifications of that, right? And so our proposal is just, we're just gonna have a 180 day category. We're getting rid of the 6 month category. But some of those 180 day offenses will be jury demandable.
All be jury demandable unless otherwise.
Well then,
or the other way.
Those would be some comments to put in writing. There you go. Either way, I will say this: we would like to kind of simplify that and to make clear that in each section, whichever way the default is set, which is the exception, But yes, I'll look forward to your comments on that point. Any other questions or concerns?
On page 15, if nobody's done anything, maybe I haven't picked the page 15 enough. All right. D, alternative maximum fine for organizational dependents?
Yes.
I know that this is basically taken out of current law.
Yeah.
But I'm not ever sure why that was put in current law quite phrased that way.
Okay.
What we're talking about is an organizational defendant, and it says, let's see, sorry, a little inspiration. A defendant is convicted of a Class A misdemeanor. First of all, I don't know why Class A, as opposed to any other. Why not a Class B misdemeanor?
Right.
Or
and,
Class
and,
C
right,
misdemeanor.
And again, we were just tracking current law.
But I'm saying it's convicted of a misdemeanor or a felony or whatever. I actually have even less sympathy for organizational defendants than I do for individual defendants because they tend to do, you know, things very money-oriented.
Yeah.
And I was looking at the non-organizational defendant, so I was wondering why we couldn't say something double the applicable amount under subsection A of this section, or twice the maximum amount specified in the law setting forth the penalty under 22-25701, 71.01.
Which is equivalent to our subsection A.
Yeah.
So, I'm sorry, so substantively, what would be the change?
The change would be it would allow, first of all, for any misdemeanor, organizational to have to pay a maximum fine that's greater, no matter what the misdemeanor is.
Yeah.
But the second, it would increase the amount of fine that an organizational defendant would have to be, depending upon what the maximum amount specified is. So look at 22-35701.01. I have another one actually. I skipped this one.
We can come back.
This is just the Proportionality Act, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
Look at C and D.
Okay, you're in 0.01.
Now look at C and D.
C and D.
Of
0.01.
3571.01, yeah, C and D. See, an organization of 6 months or more may be fined not more than the greatest of twice the maximum amount specified in the law.
So, right, you know, and again, like that assumes there is something, a special deviation, which at this point we're not counting on. Twice the amount applicable under subsection B, and B goes up here to the standard Fine Proportionality Act, pegging certain fines, under A, which is the except as provided in 102. Yeah, I'm not sure how that's.
Okay, So go back there for a second.
Okay.
Let me just get that language in my head. Notwithstanding any other provision, the imprisonment may be sentenced to pay a fine as follows, right?
Mm-hmm.
So basically, what you're saying is in here, go back down to D to C again, I'm sorry.
And I'm sorry, I'm looking right now. This is printed in the memo on page. Oh, I'm sorry, Dave.
It seems to me that C is broader than A.
It seems that C is broader than A currently.
Yes.
Twice the maximum.
And because it says any offense punishable by imprisonment
for six months or more. And the question is, why with an organizational defendant do we have a break of 6 months or more?
Right.
Considering.
Yeah.
To control a fine
when
the likelihood is they're not going to jail anyhow.
Right. So
my suggestion is merely on that one, is to consider pegging it to
just
not necessarily C, but to the subfactors of C, which allows for a greater fine for organizational defendants. That's really where I'm going with all of this.
Okay. So you're saying even if the organizational defendant, which is probably most likely the case, is punished by something of less than six months in prison, the same penalty should...
Yes, and it should be the broader
exception
fine.
Should apply.
Yeah.
That's penalty... So this is a penalty proposal.
Yeah.
Yes. And I only mention because it's you got theta.
Yeah. Other thoughts on this? You know, I think we mentioned again the new ALI provisions are more draconian, right? They're quadruple.
Quintuple.
Quintuple.
So 5 times the amount for organizations.
Yeah. You know, so they're shooting significantly higher than current district law in terms of. Now, well, although they also like they're pushing down at the bottom, so the differential anyway. But certainly open to that. This may be an issue that like we also want to see where things stand at the end as to like the fairness or proportionality of that. Again, there are only certain offenses where practically this is going to happen, where you're going to have organizational defendants, right? Most likely, and so it's really for those. Depending on where the penalties and the fines are normally, then you might want to, at that point, assess, okay, is double that the appropriate amount for organizational defendants, or is it quintuple or something different? Does it go all the way down? Misdemeanors, white-collar misdemeanors. I don't know what, you know...
Regulatory offenses, maybe.
Yeah.
Or breakdowns from greater offenses.
Nothing's leaping to mind as to like how that would apply, but... We also couldn't tell from the, you know, the Fine Proportionality Act legislative history. You all know you are the legislative history, the living legislative history. It didn't address why, in kind of readopting this language, why it set this at the 6 month level, 6 months or above. Our speculation was simply this jury demand, right? Like, you know, that for some reason you wanted organizational defendants being subjected to a potentially a very high fine amount would be only for jury demandable offenses. That's speculation because we didn't find that in legislative history, so we don't know also why that's in current law, this 6 month language. If anybody, you know, again, I think the reasonable speculation is to say it was about jury demandability, but so unless we kind of know the rationale for the current thing. That looms out there as a line drawing exercise that we need to draw a line here somewhere. So we just went with existing law. You want to draw it the other direction? Great. Put in the comments.
Yeah.
Any opposition? Okay. Put in the comments. Yeah.
Let me go to the one that I
please.
Skipped by mistake.
Okay. Yeah.
And I was wondering what the purpose of this was. In the end of page 14, beginning of 15, you talk about alternate maximum fines based on pecuniary loss. So we talk about fines here, not, you know, restitution or anything else. And when you go to page 15, subparagraph C3, you say the last sentence, the pecuniary loss or pecuniary gain must be alleged in the indictment and proven beyond a reasonable doubt. And my question is, why does that have to be in there? Or should it only be in there if the fine imposed exceeds the sanction in subsection A? Which to me then makes sense, because otherwise it should be assumed.
Right. Okay. So again,
that tracks with E2.
This, right. So subsection C, again, and this is all kind of, again, basically tracking existing law, right? Including this provision. So what you're questioning is the basis for current law.
Which is what we're changing all through.
Exactly.
Right?
Absolutely. But I just want to be clear that, like, what we were doing was replicating this. Now, it's unclear from the legislative history where this came from or underlying rationale for this. Again, presumably it's...
where I'm coming from is this.
Yeah.
If the penalty, if the fine is something that would be a typical fine,
then you normally
wouldn't have to separately plead it just because it has to do with pecuniary loss.
Sure.
But I can understand, and I think maybe constitutionally required, that if we're giving a fine that exceeds that because of some other provision, that you then would have to allege the other provision. So my suggestion, and it will be in my report, is that at the end of that, you say if the, you add to the end of 3, if the fine imposed exceeds the sanction in subsection A. Because then you're required to allege something greater than what the defendant would expect otherwise.
That certainly seems a reasonable, that seems reasonable. To me, but you know, again, if anybody else wants to have a different view on that, please chime in on the, in particular in comments. But that definitely seems reasonable. Other comments or questions? Any of the other language? All right. Well, if not, maybe I will just, since we don't have anything more, I will poke a bit and just see if anybody really no questions about the, particularly setting the class B, right? So this was in the offense classes, you know, we're setting the imprisonment penalty at a 45-year level. And we tried to explain what was behind that, right? We took the, essentially, this...
You said class B?
Class 2. So up on the screen, you can kind of see that the, you know, counting down, you got life without release, 45, 30, 20. Now, again, go back to the caveats at the beginning, we will need to look at this more closely at the end, and maybe that's just where everybody needs to, like, you know, hold your powder until then. But I just wanted to be clear that why we did that was to, you know, try to do something that's realistic in this area. It seemed like the council struggled with this, right, in the early 2000s with the changeover to determinate sentencing. It had, you know, different recommendations from, you know, from USAO, from the, at that point, was it called the Advisory Commission on Sentencing? I don't know, you know, like, it had a different name at the point, you know, the Sentencing Commission. You know, the council came up with yet a third solution. There was a lot floating out there, and the bottom line is, you know, this is a tough zone, right? Parole allows flexibility that is just largely off the table now with the way determinate sentencing works in the BOP. I mean, you're getting 85% of at least, you know, whatever the number is. So,
Slightly more. So
you know, in the memo, we tried to, you know, put out the chart kind of saying, okay, you enter at this age, how would this, you know, potentially work? Frankly, there are no great solutions for what we're trying to do, which was, again, finding indeterminate numbers something equivalent to what used to be life, right? Because, again, depending on, you know, if you have a very young offender, you know, a 20-year-old with a very serious, you know, 85%, 45 years, tack that on for a 20-year-old or 22-year-old, where does that get you? You know, it's not going to be to that person's life expectancy. These calculations are tough. It raises a lot of tough questions. There's been increasing litigation in the juvenile area, right, about what is a functional life sentence and a life without parole sentence for juveniles, mainly because you have a constitutional hook, so there's actual litigation there. Anyway. So this is our best shot at it, and I really just want to flag that as, like, we understand that this is going to be a matter for everybody to look at hard. The ALI recommendations go lower than this significantly. A number of states are, we put in the memo, states are kind of all over the map. There are some that are more severe than 45 years, not many. Most are lower than that for what they call the penultimate penalty. But, you know, this is so I would just say look closely at that as we go forward. And if you think as we go through specific offenses, I'm not going to come up with property offenses, but, you know, if you think a specific offense doesn't fit with these categories because 45, it's somewhere between 30 and 45 in life without release, please note it. Because when, as we develop whatever, you know, our first draft is for penalties going to be, the more we have input up front about, like, how we need to change things, the better. So
why do we go below the or above the ALI? Is this our own actuarial estimate or what?
Yeah, so this was based on what we took in this zone was, you know, we have a number of offenses, murder offenses, you know, severe sex offenses in this zone. And what we ended up going with was the Federal Sentencing Commission's, and it's gotten very little fanfare or much attention to kind of what they call the equivalent of a life sentence based on their stats as to when a federal offender entering the BOP system, what would be a life equivalent sentence for them based on average life expectancy. Now, this is definitely, you know, is that appropriate a marker to use? Well, you know, they come up with 470 months, which, you know, 85% of, you know, 45 years gets, you know, very close to that. For, you know, is that an appropriate? You know, that these are judgment calls, and there's no standard out there. And I will say, with respect to the ALI recommendations on this, you know. You know, we will take a look at it again with the final recommendations if there were any tweaks. So we will do that. They're envisioning, you know, we're going with more classes. They recommend 5 felony classes. You know, we're upping that, right, to have more spread, to allow for more gradations. So partly that puts pressure to have more also up as well as down. So that's one reason why we kind of differ from them. Is we're spreading it out more and trying to be a bit more refined. They do that because they're generally assuming and recommending presumptive guideline-type systems, where the Sentencing Commission is doing the further work of carving out these statutory classes into you know, more refined categories at a practical everyday level. So it's interesting, the ALI recommendations, this is a theme running throughout as they, over the, you know, 10-year development, it started in the early 2000s, you know, increasingly in the U.S., there was a shift away from these presumptive or guidelines systems and, you know, Supreme Court case law on you know, changing the effect of the federal sentencing guidelines, you know, a lot of development in this area such that what they ended up with is they at some points put in recommendations specific to jurisdictions that do not have presumptive guideline systems. They don't always include that in the ALI recommendations. Sometimes the default is that they are assuming that otherwise their recommendations apply to any kind of system. But many of their, they do at points carve out how a jurisdiction such as ours could have a special version of their recommendations. This was not one of those areas, and it is one where I think, again, you know, we don't have a guideline system that goes there, right? Like that carves out penalty classes at the top level or even in some of the mid levels in a different way. So it's a long-winded response to say, like, you know, various bases and ways to distinguish what the ALI was recommending, but I'm definitely open to everybody's comments. Should it go lower? Should it go higher? I will say, I think until we get to offenses against persons, because this is, you know, this is all aggravated and major felonies, you know, stuff that's going to be floating there. Until we kind of look at those offenses, it may not make sense to, like, say more specifically, but yeah.
Yeah, I would suggest, I mean, taking a close look at the commentary to the ALI. For example, for the class two, do you know what their number is? Do you know offhand what the number is?
For the ALI recommendation?
Yeah.
I believe it's 30.
Yeah. That's a huge difference.
Bryson might correct me. It actually might even be lower. It was somewhere in the materials, too. I think we tucked it away. And again, I agree it's a big difference.
Just as a matter of principle, I would, in terms of a guide or model, I much prefer the ALI than the federal criminal, the Federal Sentencing Commission's recommendations. And I think if you track our code, it's more like the ALI than it is like the federal sentencing guidelines.
Thank you. Any other thoughts or comments on this point, or again, any others? Really, I you know, there's nothing else we affirmatively wanted to raise at this point. Again, I know you all are working on comments. Hopefully, today's sparked maybe some other ideas if you need to write something down. Any more comments or concerns? Otherwise, that's all we have for now. And I would say again, we're either later today. Depending on how much we manage to finalize here, we'll be getting out recommendations on attempt, which is hopefully not going to be, hopefully will be well received to everybody, I'm sure. And then enhancements. And I guess I would just say on enhancements, we're not doing everything across the board right now. We're doing the broad general penalty enhancements, because what particularly we need for property offenses, which is the first thing we're going to hit, is to know how bias related crime enhancements, the hate crime enhancement, that applies broadly to all felonies or to all offenses, right? So that is one that we wanted to set out and show, hey, here's how it's going to be defined. Still wait on the penalties, but to know that that enhancement is always going to be out there and available for these property offenses as you look at them. It's going to cover offenses committed during release. It's going to cover recidivist enhancements, right, which is a general enhancement under two different statutes right now, which it's all very complicated. So it'll address those. It's not going to go into the, at this point, the more impactful and commonly used while armed crime of violence enhancement, or the other crime of violence enhancements. That we will do more. We want some more time to look at that, and we also want to see more kind of where we're going to go with offenses against persons. So that's why we're going to wait a bit on that. But I think this will help to be able to process and look at property offenses, to know what's out there, and to know kind of how the enhancement system will work with this new set of classes. That's what we're getting out to.
How about things like the age of the victim?
Right. So
is that now or is that later?
Yeah, later. So these, those are, the senior enhancement, minor enhancement, the red hat, Laura always mentions, citizen patrol members is the way it's like titled. We have these other various specialty enhancements. I will say across the board, we do have data from the Sentencing Commission from a year and a half ago, further back on enhancements and while we may get some more and be able to have a different take once we look at direct from the court, the data we have now really shows virtually no practical use or impact of any statutory enhancements except for the wild-armed enhancements, which, of course, are arguably,
used plenty.
Well, they are used plenty, and they're just a huge, right? Like, it is a huge impact, right? Like, a lot of ripple effects from this, too, right? So, like, that's a very big deal. Outside of that, and we'll include, you'll see the stats that we're working off of, almost no convictions, felony convictions, which we have data, that are actually applying any of these other enhancements. Even when they are applied, they aren't actually boosting it above the otherwise applicable statutory max. And so the whole conversation about enhancements, we have a lot on the books. We have more than pretty much any jurisdiction for statutory enhancements. Whether they are ultimately desirable and useful, look forward to that conversation. Again, the big one, which is obviously useful and desirable, is the while-armed enhancement, which we're gonna wait and work on as we get to offenses against persons and see how to deal with the fact that, like, you know, guns matter, involvement of weapons. That's all I'm saying, Laura. I think even you would grant me that. Come on. So right. So that's it. I'll let you all log go. And again, if you want to stop, say hi to our interns. And they'll be with us the whole summer. So some of you, you know, talk to any, you know, availability to talk with them, great. And I'll be sending an email about scheduling for probably a mid-September meeting. It's going to be the most useful. But, yeah, see if we can find a date for everybody that works then. So with that, thank you, and we'll turn off the recorder.